Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something new is brewing at Starbucks. Introducing the White Chocolate Macadamia Cream Cold Brew. Crank up the cool, turn up the tunes, and sip on our signature cold brew, topped with White Chocolate Macadamia Cream Cold Foam and Cookie Crumble. Order yours with the Starbucks app.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 10th of May. Donald Trump is ordered to pay $5 million in damages for sexually assaulting a woman in the 1990s. So what does it mean for his presidential campaign? Protests erupt across Pakistan after the former Prime Minister Imran Khan is arrested. And we have the latest on the fighting in the Palestinian territory of Gaza. Also in the podcast, the huge rise in sexual violence targeting women in camps in eastern Congo. And
you were shot at, shelled, bombed, mortared, everything. Sometimes you were lucky, sometimes you weren't. I was lucky.
80 years on from victory in North Africa, the Second World War veteran who survived against the odds. Donald Trump sexually assaulted a woman and then defamed her by calling her a liar. That's the verdict of a jury in New York, which ordered the former president to pay E. Jean Carroll around $5 million in damages. She accused him of raping her in a department store dressing room in Manhattan in the mid-1990s. The jury in the civil case rejected the rape allegation but concluded he did sexually abuse her. In an online post, Mr. Trump described the verdict as a disgrace and said he had no idea who E. Jean Carroll was. Speaking outside court, his lawyer, Joe Tecapina, said they would appeal.
It's hard to see behind a jury room door. And I don't know what they were thinking, or what it sort of indicates is what, again, what people have been saying is that in New York, you just can't get a fair trial. And, you know, people have said you lost the case when they announced the names of the litigants. But again, they found him not liable for the rape.
Well, in a statement, E. Jean Carroll said, "Today, the world finally knows the truth. This victory is not just for me, but for every woman who suffered because she was not believed." Our reporter in New York, Samira Hussain, told me what happened in court.
It only took the jury 3 hours to deliberate when they finally came down with their decision. And remember, because this is a civil case, the burden of proof is lesser than what you would normally have in a criminal case. So it is not beyond a reasonable doubt. They just need to be convinced that what E. Jean Carroll had said, the allegations in what was presented to them, was in fact true. Now, remember, Mr. Trump did not appear in the courtroom at all. He never spoke in his defense. And in fact, the defense, in terms of what they did, they called no witnesses. What their argument was is just to try to discredit Ms. Carroll alone and not call any of their own witnesses. But it is incredible to think that now we have a former U.S. president, a former president that is currently seeking to get back into the White House, that has now been found liable of sexual assault.
Yeah, how damaging is that finding for his campaign to return to the White House?
Well, none of his legal woes have actually been damaging to the former president at all. If you look at his political strength, he's still able to maintain a significant lead over any of the announced challengers or presumed challengers for the Republican nomination. And if you ask, you know, Republican insiders, there are many that still believe that Mr. Trump is in fact going to be the nominee from the Republican Party to face U.S. President Joe Biden in his re-election campaign. You know, none of this has really damaged him politically, and in some respects, you have to say that his posts after this verdict was reached are actually part of that brand, part of that political brand that he has created.
And the end of a long legal battle by E. Jean Carroll.
It is. And, you know, I think it's very easy to get embroiled in the political aspect or the theater or the spectacle of all of this. But remember, this is the story of a woman who was sexually assaulted, which has now been proven in court, by Mr. Trump 30 years ago. And because of a change in the law in the state of New York, she was able to bring civil charges. She sat in a courtroom for 2 hours and retold her tale of this harrowing experience that forever altered her life. And after 30-some years, Ms. Carroll walked out of this courtroom a vindicated woman. And that is really an incredible thing to have happened.
Tamara Hossain outside court in New York. The military plays a huge role in Pakistani politics. It backed the cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan as Prime Minister in 2018, before turning against him as he was ousted in a parliamentary vote last year. But rather than going quietly, Mr. Khan has been campaigning relentlessly against the current government, while accusing the military of trying to assassinate him. On Tuesday, as he attended court in the capital Islamabad, Imran Khan was arrested on corruption charges, sparking massive protests by his supporters. Well, that was Peshawar, and there were similar scenes in other cities too. And for their part, the demonstrators stormed military buildings in Lahore and the garrison city of Rawalpindi. Imran Khan was already facing more than 100 charges, but his spokesman Rauf Hassan said the manner of his arrest was likely to exacerbate the nation's already dire problems.
I fear that this arrest is going to plunge the country into chaos and anarchy because we're facing multiple crises. There's an economic crisis. There is a political crisis. There is a cost of livelihood crisis. Consequently, you know, this occasion shall be a catharsis for them to step out, you know, and I fear that a fair amount of violence is going to creep in.
Imran Khan spokesman Rauf Hassan. I got the latest from our correspondent in Pakistan, Farhat Javed.
These protests started across Pakistan following Imran Khan's arrest, and they are increasing. I mean, protesters, we saw them attacking military installations. They attacked general headquarters in Rawalpindi. They entered its premises, and in one video, we could see his supporters entering cantonments and attacking residences of senior army commanders, for example. So this has been unprecedented. Right now, we are getting reports from across the country where protesters are blocking roads. They are burning police vehicles and check posts and chanting slogans against country's power. Powerful military and the government, and police is also arresting them. So far, we have confirmation of one death, one protester killed in the southern city of Quetta in Pakistan, and several protesters who have been arrested. And we are also getting reports of more than 50 police officials who are injured in these protests, and they have been taken to the hospital.
So are we seeing a power struggle between the military and Imran Khan and his supporters? And if so, who is likely to win it?
The military has been facing such kind of, you know, protests and opposition from different political parties in the past as well. But this time it is huge. And we have never seen this sort of protest where supporters of a political party try to enter military headquarters, for example, or attack military installations. This has never happened before. So it seems that this time they are facing some real opposition in the streets of Pakistan. But the history has it in Pakistan. Military remains very strong. And it's not that Imran Khan has all the supporters. There are many people in the country who are against the narrative that Imran Khan is selling. I mean, they say that Imran Khan is making the society more polarized now and inciting people against their armed forces. What we can say right now is that military remains powerful, but at the same time, Imran Khan also has a huge support both in urban and rural areas of Pakistan.
Farhat Javed in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. There are fears of an escalation in the fighting in Israel and the Palestinian territories after Israeli airstrikes killed 15 people in Gaza in the early hours of Tuesday. Three Islamic Jihad leaders died along with 12 others in what Israel said was an operation targeting militants who posed an immediate threat. Islamic Jihad have vowed to avenge the killings, while the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened a crushing response. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman has the details.
Well, what we saw were several waves of very intensive but targeted airstrikes taking place during the night. Now, the initial wave, it seemed, targeted apartments in blocks, both in central Gaza, in Gaza City, and then south in Rafah. And what they were obviously doing here was targeting these three commanders in the military wing of Islamic Jihad, killing them, but also killing members of their families, including wives and children in some cases. So those three were killed. Another family were also killed nearby in the centre of Gaza City, in fact, very near to where the BBC office is in the centre of the city there. The strike, both killing the targeted militant, members of his family, and also a family above, a well-known dentist in Gaza, and his wife and one of his children, one of his sons there. So asked about the civilian deaths, I mean, the Israelis have acknowledged this and have said that they work to minimise civilian deaths, but referred to it earlier as collateral damage. But I think really what we're seeing tactically or strategically here by the Netanyahu government is really, we've seen this partially happening in the occupied West Bank over recent months, but this is a clear return to the tactic of targeted killings. And what they've said they're doing here is trying to focus on members of Islamic Jihad, senior commanders that they say are behind recent rocket attacks against Israel, but also coordinating attacks in the occupied West Bank. And that's where we've really seen the tensions boil in the region over the last year, is the moving of a front, you know, from Gaza to the occupied West Bank, really since the conflict of May 2021, but particularly over the last year or so.
Our Middle East correspondent, Tom Bateman. The head of Russia's Wagner mercenary group has hit out at leaders of the Russian armed forces, accusing them of trying to deceive President Putin about the fighting in Ukraine. Yevgeny Prigozhin, a longtime critic of the regular military, chose the annual Victory Day commemoration to post a lengthy video on social media. He repeated his call for more ammunition for his Wagner fighters and went on to ridicule those in charge of the war effort, including a figure he referred to as the happy grandfather.
Instead of using a shell to kill an enemy and saving one of our soldiers' lives, they're killing our soldiers, and the happy grandfather thinks that he's fine. If he turns out to be right, then may God grant everyone health. But what should the country do? Our children, grandchildren, who are the future of Russia. And how can he win this war if, by chance, and I'm just speculating here, it turns out that this grandfather is a complete moron?
Well, in Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky made an appeal of his own, calling on the European Union to formally open talks on Ukrainian membership. Speaking in Kiev alongside the visiting European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, President Zelensky said economic and political barriers between Ukraine and the EU were playing into Russia's hands, and he called for them to be lifted. More from Hugo Bachega in Kiev.
As Russia celebrated Victory Day, Ukraine gave a clear sign of its break from the orbit of Moscow. In Kyiv, President Zelensky hosted the head of the EU Commission. Ursula von der Leyen's visit was a show of European support and deep in symbolism. On the day the EU marks Europe Day, a celebration of unity. A day that will now be marked here in Ukraine too.
Kyiv, as the capital of Ukraine, is the beating heart of today's European values. Ukraine is on the front line of the defense of everything we Europeans cherish.
The two leaders talked about Ukraine's war needs. Kyiv has been calling for the faster delivery of ammunition as it prepares to launch a counteroffensive. It is also urging the EU to implement a new package of sanctions against Russia. And then there were Ukraine's EU aspirations. President Zelensky said it was time to open membership talks and that he expected progress in the next EU summit in June. Just hours before they met, Russia targeted Kyiv again. All cruise missiles launched at the city were destroyed by air defense systems in the fifth attack on the capital in 9 days.
Hugo Bachega in Kyiv. It's been confirmed that a baby has been born using DNA from three people for the first time in the UK. The DNA came from two parents and a woman donor who supplied 0.1% of the genetic material. The pioneering technique, known as mitochondrial donation, is an attempt to prevent children inheriting incurable diseases. It uses tissues from the eggs of healthy female donors to create IVF embryos that are free from harmful mutations their mothers carry. Dagan Wells, Professor of Reproductive Genetics at the University of Oxford, has been talking to Julian Warwicker.
The UK has really led in terms of the regulation of and development of these kinds of techniques. In fact, it's often seen as a paradigm of how you would bring in a very advanced genetic technology and bring it into clinical use. The way that this was debated in public over a number of years, ultimately debated in Parliament and finally passed into law to allow this to be done in this country. And certainly we led the way in that respect. There have been births elsewhere, a very small number using this methodology, but not in a really controlled and well-regulated way for avoiding these very serious inherited conditions.
And mitochondrial disease, for those who aren't familiar with it, what does it involve?
Well, as you rightly mentioned, every cell of our body pretty much has thousands of these tiny mitochondria, and they have a small amount of their own DNA. In fact, 1.5 billion years ago, they were actually a completely independent organism, but they now live inside our cells and have done for a very long time. Just like our own genes, you can have mutations occur in the small amount of DNA that are in the mitochondria. Their main function is to produce energy for our cells, so defects in their genes mean that the cells don't get enough energy. And that can lead to a whole slew of quite nasty problems, including vision loss, hearing problems, muscle weakness, neurological issues, heart, liver, kidney disease, and early death, sometimes even in infancy. So they're quite nasty conditions, which, of course, you want to avoid transmitting.
And does this technique have potential applications to other inherited conditions?
Not so much to other inherited conditions. The mitochondria are pretty unique in the job they do and having this little piece of DNA that can be transferred. But there have been suggestions that it could also be used to treat certain types of infertility that are characterized by very poor egg quality and an inability to produce embryos that successfully develop. That's usually an egg problem. And as well as changing the mitochondria in this particular technology, they also really change the entire egg. So that's a possibility too.
And where do things go now in terms of taking this forward?
It's very exciting that there is at least a couple of births. They haven't said exactly how many because they want to protect the anonymity of the patients and their families, quite rightly. So we know it's something between maybe 2 and 4 or 5 births that have occurred. That's very exciting, but we don't really know whether it's actually worked yet, because the team that's leading this work, which is an excellent group of scientists in Newcastle, they have not yet shared that information in the public domain. So we hope that it's all been going perfectly well, and we all eagerly await that actual confirmation. The babies who are born will also need years of follow-up just to make sure that it's really worked, they have very low levels of mutant mitochondria that aren't causing clinical problems, and that those levels stay low throughout their life, and that they don't get any unexpected health problems later on.
Dagan Wells, talking to Julian Warwicker. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The city has been described as our greatest invention, and it is very much the future, and it's very much the response to climate change, which is, in essence, an act of design.
The British architect Norman Foster talks to the BBC about a new exhibition dedicated to his work. The number of people displaced by fighting in Sudan has more than doubled in a week, according to the UN's Migration Organization. Fighting is continuing in the capital Khartoum with reports of airstrikes and shooting, even as the army and its paramilitary rivals hold talks in Saudi Arabia. Barbara Plett-Usher in Nairobi gave us the latest.
We've known that the humanitarian situation is getting worse as the fighting continues, but the UN has now put some new figures on that. So the number of people displaced within the country has doubled just in the past week. It's now 700,000. Bear in mind that even before the conflict started, there were nearly 4 million people internally displaced. So this is a new crisis building on an old one. And another 150,000 people have fled outside the country. We've also got an update on confirmed casualty figures, more than 600 dead and around 5,000 wounded, but almost certainly the actual numbers are way higher than that. In Khartoum, residents say that the airstrikes have not stopped. There are sporadic gun battles, but there's also been a surge in looting because the police aren't on the streets. And those talks in Jeddah continue between representatives on both sides to try to get a humanitarian truce in order to get aid into the country and to get essential services working again. But there's been no outward sign of progress.
Barbara Platt-Usher on events in Sudan. The medical charity MSF says there's been a huge rise in sexual violence targeting women in camps around Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. MSF says that in the past 2 weeks, it's treated more than 670 victims. Myeni Jones reports.
These latest figures from MSF are startling. In the last 2 weeks of April, the charity treated on average 48 new victims of sexual violence per day. The majority of the assaults are recent, with victims seeking treatment within 72 hours of being attacked. Most of them were assaulted while searching for firewood around camps for the displaced near Goma on the eastern border with Rwanda. The charity says the real number of victims is likely much higher, as it can only count those that seek its services. More than half of those that have come forward report being attacked by armed men. Fighting between government forces and armed rebel groups in the eastern DRC has caused hundreds of thousands of people to flee to overcrowded camps in and around the city of Goma.
Myeni Jones. It's been hailed as a watershed moment for international sport. A US doctor's become the first person convicted under a new American law introduced after Russia's state-sponsored doping scandals. Eric Lira faces up to 10 years in prison for supplying performance-enhancing drugs to Olympic athletes. I heard more about the case from our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
Well, this is all to do with the Rodchenkov Act, which was named after Grigory Rodchenkov. He was the guy, the inside man who blew the whistle on that state-run doping program in Russia. And what it means is that the FBI, they can chase members of the athletes' entourages who might be helping them commit doping violations. Eric Lira, in this case, was a man who had a selection of athletes that he was working with, including Blessing Okagbari. She's a Nigerian sprinter, a former Olympic silver medalist who was expelled, ejected from the Tokyo Olympics. Eric Lira has admitted that he supplied her with performance-enhancing drugs. He admitted his guilt. He could get a jail sentence of anything up to 10 years. And that's happened because under the Rodchenkov Act, his activities are now a crime.
So this is the first time it's been used in anger. Does this signal a change in the way that cheating is going to be tackled across sports in future?
Well, it's been called a watershed moment, as you mentioned, by the chief prosecutor, the attorney in the US, in New York, in the Southern District of New York. It was also described as a landmark moment by the head of the US anti-doping agency, Travis Tygart, who's been pushing hard for the Rodchenkov Act. It was introduced by Donald Trump in 2020. And he says it's important because it shows that the US are committed to providing a level playing field ahead of some big events that are coming up there in the next few years, the Olympics in 2028 and the World Cup in 2026. And it also allows federal officials, the FBI, the US authorities to travel abroad to chase people who may have a connection with the US. They can go after these individuals abroad if they want to.
But not everyone's happy about it.
No, WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, has always resisted the creation of this Rodchenkov Act. And it's because it's not consistent with the WADA code. Now, the WADA code has been governing anti-doping rules and regulations for decades. They don't want other rules and regulations to perhaps get in the way. And they're also worried what it will mean for potential whistleblowers. They might not want to approach sports authorities with the information they have if they think there's a chance that it might involve the US authorities and might implicate them. So they're worried about that as well.
Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick. This month marks the 80th anniversary of the Allies' victory in North Africa in the Second World War. Desert fighting in Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco and Algeria went on for nearly 3 years. It was a turning point in the Second World War and made the Allied invasion of Southern Europe possible. Our correspondent Alan Little met one former soldier aged 103 who was a veteran of the campaign.
Generals Eisenhower, Giraud, Alexander and Anderson, the big four in North Africa, take their place on the rostrum and the victory parade through Tunis is on.
Peter Royal is looking at British Pathé footage of the Allies' victory parade in Tunis in May 1943. He spots himself marching past the rostrum.
Are you in this?
Yes.
That's you there?
Yeah. Sir, from the left. 1, 2, 3.
Peter was a captain in the Royal Artillery, a forward spotter in the North Africa campaign, which put him in the front line of the advance on German defences.
You were shot at, shelled, bombed, mortared, everything. And you got that dreadful feeling of sickness in your tummy. Oh, God, is this going to be the last time? You didn't know. Sometimes you were lucky, sometimes you weren't. I was lucky.
The order of the day is wipe out the Axis in Africa. Every communique tells how the German and Italian columns are being relentlessly pursued and destroyed.
When you have a shell bursting 3 feet away from you, you don't expect to live. There's an awful lot of metal flying around. It happened to me in my first battle when I was hit in the chin by a piece of metal which lodged itself in my jawbone. I should have been killed then. I think I should have been killed 5 or 6 times. I don't think I should be talking to you now. I think I should have been buried in a North African field 75, 80 years ago.
Peter was from a well-off family in Lancashire and had planned to become a country solicitor. But combat brought him close and unexpected friendships, which reached across pre-war class divides, and especially with the 4 men he fought alongside in the hills of Tunisia, month after month.
My 4 companions, they were sort of working-class men. You had a bond with those 4. Couldn't be taken away from you. You and the other 4 had gone to the brink of death and come back. And that happened 4 or 5 or 6 times. You got a feeling of complete comradeship with him. Nothing could take it away.
The news that all the world that fights for freedom has been wanting to hear. The Axis forces in the desert are in full retreat. The enemy are on the run, and we are after them.
Victory right in the desert field, turned the course no of the war. It prepared the way for the liberation of southern Europe. Peter had already fought in France. He was at Dunkirk. After North Africa, he fought again in Italy. This is how he recollects his role.
If you didn't kill that the other chap, he killed you. That was it. Capture the objective. Fight. Kill people. Awful, isn't it? I've killed my fellow man. I'm not proud of that. But I didn't go around sticking bayonets into them. My killing was at a long range. 1,000 yards, 2,000 yards away from the people I killed. That's awful. But war is awful.
In Italy, he was shot by a German machine gun in another hill battle. From his hospital bed, he sent a telegram to his parents.
I said, wounded. Bullets, left arm, left leg. Not serious. Should survive. I thought that might amuse them. And he did.
That interview with Peter Royal was recorded with Alan Little earlier this year. Peter died in March at the age of 103. The British architect Norman Foster has left a huge impression around the world. From the Gherkin building here in London to the Reichstag in Berlin, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and airports in Hong Kong and Beijing, his structures are built to impress but also to fit in with the environment. Now, a retrospective exhibition of his work is opening at the Pompidou Centre in Paris. Lord Foster told Justin Webb about the different elements on display.
The invitation of the Pompidou president was encouraged to cast the net a bit wider to include works of art, painting, sculpture, automobiles, a high-performance sailplane, the inspirations, breaking down the barriers, if you like, between art, architecture and design.
I just wonder what you think about the kind of the role of the car in the modern world, given electric vehicles and the bog-standardness of so much automobile design. Are we losing out on something that's had its grand days?
I think it's had its peak in terms of the car-born city. Interestingly, we're seeing a return to the pedestrian-friendly, the walkable city. We're seeing cities reversing the priorities from the car to the pedestrian, which I think makes the city more healthy, greener, more friendly. But mobility is very much here to stay. So I don't think society is suddenly going to go static.
How do we reapproach architecture then, given those things, those strictures that you've just talked about?
I think you could say the only constant is change. Cities and buildings are in a continuous state of evolution, and history would tell us that crises, pandemics, earthquakes, fires, the city bounces back stronger than it was before. If you think of London in the middle of the 19th century, cholera, it accelerated positive change. It created the Thames Embankment. It cleaned up the Thames itself. It brought in modern sanitation. Cholera accelerated those changes. And in every case, whether it's New York, Central Park, the reservoir, clean water, the effects of these pandemics and crises has historically, in the end, a positive effect.
Where is the balance between the values, the imagination, the stuff that comes from someone like you and the constraints of modernity, whenever modernity is?
I think you have to go back to the roots of what we would call modern architecture, which is not about style or fashion. It was a response to public health. It was the era of tuberculosis. And modern architecture brought in the contact with nature and really establishing a better balance between the inside and the outside of spaces. So it was an age of sanatoria, outdoor terraces, and all the things that we perhaps take for granted as life expectancy extends, infant mortality reduces. So the roots of the architecture that we call modern is very much about health.
Final thought about the King, who has strong views on architecture. You're looking forward to talking to him about those views if you get the chance. Indeed, have you in the past?
I'd love to have the opportunity of talking about the benefits of change, of a healthier architecture, an architecture which is more sustainable. And of course, the infrastructure of a city is the urban glue, the connections, the bridges that binds the individual buildings together. And the city has been described as our greatest invention. And it is very much the future. And it's very much the response to climate change, which is, in essence, an act of design.
Lord Norman Foster talking to Justin Webb. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.